This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good morning and welcome to The Friends. Alison Wishart is a curator with the National Museum of Australia and is responsible for putting on a wonderful series of staff seminars here quite regularly. She's worked as a curator previously at the Museum of Tropical Queensland in Townsville, the State Library of Queensland, and of course here at the museum. She has a BA Honours from the University of Queensland, has completed a Master's in Museum Studies and Cultural Heritage at Deakin University. And I believe the Flora Pell stuff is part of Alison's thesis, or research work at least. So I'm looking forward to hearing Alison's talk on Flora Pell. Thanks.
Thank you, Sharon. I'm going to stand behind the microphone, behind the lectern, because I need my notes. But then I hope we can make it as kind of informal, and I'm happy for you to ask questions and make comments and things like that, because I can see that there's probably some very experienced cooks in the room. And Flora Pell was an excellent cook. So I'll tell you about what I've come to learn about Flora Pell and how much I respect her, and then there'll be plenty of time for questions and discussion at the end, okay? So I began doing this work when I came to the National Museum with someone by the name of Adele Wessel. Adele actually works from Southern Cross University based in Lismore, but she was lucky enough to get a fellowship to come to the National Museum and study our cookbook collection. And she sent round an email saying, is anyone else interested in cookbooks? And I responded, and so we got together and discovered our mutual interest in cookbooks, and really think that writing about food should be taken seriously, because food writing and cookbooks are both an agent of and a record of historical and social change. So in my talk today, I'll talk about how cookbooks, and particularly cookbooks written by Flora Pell, are both agents of and records of social change and historical change in society. So we've particularly been focusing on Flora Pell's most popular publication called Our Cookery Book. And I hope by the end of this talk you'll agree with me that it reveals a lot about Australia and about women in the first half of the 20th century, which is when Flora Pell was writing. But I think equally her work can resonate for us today in the 21st century. So I'll briefly try and sketch how Flora Pell's writing about food has advocated changes in society, but also reflects some of those changes. So who's ever watched Nigella Lawson or Maggie Beer on the telly? Yep, those celebrity chefs or celebrity cooks. Well, they weren't the first. They're our predecessors, and her name is Flora Pell. Now, while she may look more like the type of cook who would smack your hands for licking the bowl than suggestively lick her fingers, as Nigella Lawson does, don't be deceived. Flora Pell was a first-rate, published and celebrated chef. She travelled to the USA on a study and lecture tour of cookery schools in 1923. She had her own spot on Melbourne's 3LO radio, which is now 777, like the ABC local radio station in Melbourne, for 3 years, from 1925 to 28. And she toured business, women's and charity groups to talk about cooking. Her ideas about nutrition, domestic economy and the education of girls were often taken up and promoted by her friend Stella Allen, who wrote under the pseudonym of Vesta in a weekly column in the Argus newspaper, which was a Melbourne newspaper. So in this weekly Women to Women column, she talks about some of Flora Pell's ideas. So Flora Pell's influence extended well beyond the kitchen. Her three cookbooks are highly regarded. And you can see the use of Flora Pell's name in the third one, in the title of the third one, Miss Flora Pell's Tested Cookery Dishes and Valuable Home Hints, which I think implies that by the time it was published in 1925, Flora Pell was a household name. Now, her most popular cookery book is the centre one, Our Cookery Book, It was reprinted over 24 times from 1916 until the 1950s. Its sheer popularity and endurance, we think, make it an important object of study. Recently, Adele and I spoke at the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival about Flora Pell in Melbourne in March. And before that, we wrote a small article for The Age that was published in the Epicure section, like the foodie lift-out section. And we had about 25 Victorians contact me after that with their memories of Flora Pell. And here are some of their comments. My mother, Lynette Parker, adores Flora Pell's cookbook, which she treasures and refers to many times over and over again. Alicine Stevens said, my mother and her sisters swore by her book and I still have my mother's battered copy. Mum used to say she liked her because the instructions were so clear and basic. Mum used to joke they were, walk into the kitchen, approach the stove, etc. And then Lorna Roberts, Nelva Roberts and Valerie O'Brien's mothers used the book at school and say that Flora Pell was our Bible. Alison Taylor says, my mother always quoted Flora Pell as an authority. The recipe book was used over and over until the pages were badly discoloured and the book fell apart. Has anyone else got a cookbook like that at home? Do any of you have relatives or ancestors who used Flora Pell's cookbook? I think it is more of a Victorian phenomenon because she taught in Victorian primaries or high schools, or they were becoming high schools. And finally, there's three other women who received copies of Our Cookery Book as wedding presents well after the last publication date in the 1950s. And Coral Waugh was given a copy when she got married in 1967. So just to give you a bit more info about Flora Pell the person, she was born in Melbourne on the 12th of March 1874. So about 137 years ago. She started work as a teacher when she was 15 and went on to become an instructor in cookery at schools in Geelong and Bendigo and then in the Melbourne suburb of Carlton. A bit like today where you have to kind of do your regional service or your country service before you can get a job in the city. In 1906, she organised the cookery section at the Victorian State Schools exhibition. And this, I think, provides an early glimpse into the importance that she placed on food in what we call nation building and the contribution that she believed women could make to that. When she was promoted in 1908 to the supervisor of cookery at the Melbourne Continuation School, her report card says that Flora Pell has undertaken the training of our first cookery teachers. So she taught cookery teachers. And that she was exceedingly hardworking, capable, interested, reliable, enthusiastic, and tactful. Miss Pell is a valuable public servant. Now, this was written about her in 1908. I just want you to remember how highly she was regarded by her employer, the Victorian Education Department, in 1908, because we'll come back to her career with the Education Department a bit later. So she goes on to rise through the ranks of the Victorian Education Department until she's headmistress of Collingwood Domestic Arts School, which is still standing, which opened in 1915. Now, while she was in charge of this school, she seized the opportunity of a meeting in Melbourne in June 1918 when all the State Education Department directors came to Melbourne and she organised for her cookery students to prepare and serve a four-course luncheon. So there was the Victorian Premier, the Minister for Education, the Director of Education, the Mayor of Collingwood and all the State Education directors. And she wanted them to taste the achievements of her students and they were most impressed. So she knew that good cooking could be persuasive and strategic. Okay, now we'll have a look at some of the ways that Flora Pell used her cookery book to try and change society. First of all, patriotism. Through her cookbooks and her teaching, Flora Pell espoused patriotism. She believed that nation building starts in the kitchen, and she wrote in 1906, The teaching of domestic economy is to be the power that makes the happy home. And the happy home means a prosperous nation, because from the home we must recruit our citizens. Good home life, good food, good nutrition, good citizens, good nation. So that's the link that she's drawing. Okay, so now I'm going to show you a photograph of a cookery demonstration which Flora Pell organised in 1906 at the State Schools Exhibition. And I want you to look carefully at the way the classroom is decorated. And now here's a photo of a classroom at the Melbourne Continuation School where Flora Pell taught. So what have you noticed about these photos? The flags. Yep, Australian flag there. And there were a series of flags in the other one as well. Yep. Now, I do acknowledge that it's common to have a photograph of the reigning monarch on a classroom wall well into the 1980s, but I think these flags are noteworthy. These images of cookery classrooms sent me looking for photographs of science, maths and sloyd, which is what woodwork was called then. So that's what the boys were doing when the girls were doing cooking. Sloyd classrooms from that period. But none of them had flags festooned above the students' heads. As we said, according to Flora Pell, nation building starts in the kitchen. Now, our cookery book was first published in 1916, during the height of the First World War. So with a rolling pin and a knowledge of nutrition, Pell is teaching women to raise up an army. So this is the cover of the first cookery book when it was published. And she is one of the first cookbook authors to talk about the importance of nutrition. In our cookery book, she stipulates the daily intake of foods that she called bodybuilders, which today we would call proteins. Then she also talks about heat producers, which we would call fats, and energy producers, carbohydrates. Then she also mentions water and mineral salts. Today, nutritionists would also say that vitamins and fibre are an important part of our diet, but these elements of a diet were not discovered, in a sense, until the 1940s. So when Adele and I were doing this research, we commissioned a nutritionist from the University of Canberra to examine Flora Pell's recipes and to compare her recommended daily intake of protein, fat and carbohydrate with that recommended by the NHMRC, which is the National Health and Medical Research Council. And this is what we found. So Flora Pell was advocating that for a man doing moderate work, you needed 20% protein, 20% fat and 60% carbohydrates. And the NHMRC, Australian macronutrient distribution range, her figures are definitely within that range. And interestingly, the fat one is at the lower end of the range. And this is at a time when suet and butter and animal fats are very highly used in cooking, because we haven't learnt about, you know, olive oils and different sorts of, you know, trans fats and all that sort of stuff. So her ideas about nutrition were, you know, ahead of their time, I think. So I think Pell's writings about nutrition encouraged changes in the way people thought about food and cooking. Now, her writings also talk about the role of women in society. And in terms of this, she was a living contradiction. On the one hand, she wrote and taught that a woman's place was in the home and that it was her heaven-appointed mission to be a wife and homemaker. On the other hand, Flora Pell had a very successful career. She rose through the ranks of the education department to be inspectress, as they were called then, of all the domestic arts and cookery centres in Victoria. And through royalties from her cookbooks and her career, she gained financial independence, something which a minority of women of her age and era would have experienced. She didn't marry until she was 60 years old in 1935. Ironically, she goes to write in her 1914 report on the 62 centres, which are under her guidance at this time, that the decline in household skill and the weakening of maternal instincts are traceable results of the increasing employment of women outside of their homes. So we laugh at that today, but in Flora Powell's time in 1914, 1916, paths and career paths for women other than being a wife and a homemaker and a mother were only just beginning to open up. So you really had a choice between marriage or domestic service up until then. But now, just around this time, girls were starting to get jobs in factories and could serve in shops and be dressmakers and milliners. Middle-class girls are being trained to be school teachers, secretaries or nurses, and these were positions that attracted very few men until more recently. So while these opportunities for women were limited, they did start to challenge the long-established and traditional notion that a woman's place was in the home. And what was happening is that girls were leaving school at the age of 14, but they weren't allowed to enter the workforce until they were 15. And so they didn't have a lot of time at home with their mothers to learn about cooking and domestic economy and how to run a household and things like that. So Flora Powell was arguing strongly for cookery and household management lessons in schools and the development of domestic arts colleges. And she decried the fact that girls were not displaying the same aptitude for domestic duties as did their mothers and their grandmothers. And then she even makes a link with the help of the church between the return of soldiers after World War I coming back to Australia, and many of them came back with venereal diseases, and the fact that these girls were sort of drifting between the ages of 14 and 15, so they'd finished school but they couldn't start work. And she was quite concerned that these girls would drift into the paths of these men returning from World War I, because there was a great spike in venereal diseases in Australia after World War I. And so part of her argument was that we need to give girls structure and a place where they can go, and they can not, be tempting these young men. It was the woman's responsibility not to get themselves into some trouble or strife. So she, according to Powell, the teaching of efficient management of the home involved stressing the scientific approach to good nutrition, domestic hygiene, and the elimination of waste. And there was a larger purpose to this. Pupils should regard their work not just as benefiting their home, but as serving the national good and upholding the importance and the dignity of labour in the home, rather than seeing it as servile employment. So Powell believed that nation building starts with women in the kitchen, and that steps must be taken by the government to protect the integrity and the dignity of home life as a factor in national prosperity. For Powell, the benefits of homemaking extend well beyond the kitchen, and she sees there as no higher employment than homemaking, and she says that homemaking raises up a strong race of well-nurtured people, skilled not alone in the right conduct of their own lives, but impatient of the existence of any conditions unfavourable to the health of the community. So she really promotes the role of women in the home. She sees it as a civic role, a public role in a sense, even though it's happening in a private sphere, and it's directed outwards towards serving the broader community. So I think in this way she sought to change the way society viewed the teaching of domestic arts and a woman's role in the home. And in a sense, I think she was an early advocate of domestic feminism as well. Now, Flora Powell also had a lot to say about the education of girls. Her career follows the expansion of the systematic instruction in cookery and the domestic arts movement. We'd call it home ec today, probably. She was the supervisor of cookery at the Melbourne Continuation School in 1908 and headmistress of the Collingwood Domestic Arts College when it opened 7 years later. Now, this Collingwood College that I showed you the picture of before, of that big grand building, it's the same college where Stephanie Alexander started her kitchen garden program. So the theme of that college continues today. In 1924, she became inspectress, as I've said, of all the domestic arts centres throughout Victoria, and this was a position that she held until her retirement in 1929. And in these roles and through the publication of Our Cookery Book, which became a textbook, Pell imbued her students with the general principles of cooking and a strong sense of cooking and eating which goes well beyond the kitchen. So support for the training of girls in domestic colleges happens around the time that other organisations are springing up, like the National Council for Women and suffragette groups. In 1915, the Victorian Education Department responded finally to public pressure for more domestic training for girls, and they established two domestic arts colleges in Melbourne, in Fitzroy and Collingwood. So girls between the ages of 12 and 14 would attend these centres for 2 days per week to learn about cooking, laundry, sewing, household management, etc., and then attend a normal high school for the other 3 days of the week for the 3 hours. Flora Pell was passionate about her job. She firmly believed that a girl's education was incomplete if she hadn't been trained in the principles of true household economy, cookery and nutrition. And these three things are covered in detail in Our Cookery Book and her other cookbooks. And it's interesting because we can get an understanding of what her thoughts about that were like 100 years ago. She didn't believe that homemaking was innate in women. She argued that we needed to be trained in the scientific and business principles needed for the organisation and running of a modern household. So in this way, she's advocating that the state, not mothers or grandmothers, should be responsible for training girls in household management, and that homemaking is not necessarily a natural or a cultural activity. So I think through her writings about food and women's role in society, Flora Pell's advocating for a change in the education curriculum for girls. So I've just talked about how Flora Pell's influence extends beyond the kitchen to encourage patriotism, a re-evaluation of the role of women in society, and particularly their importance in the home, and to elevate the importance of education of girls in domestic arts. But now I'm going to turn a little bit and look at how Flora Pell's writings about food reflected changes in society at the time. Our cookery book contains a recipe for Belgian pound cake. Now, there might be other cookery books that have that recipe that you've used. And it was a reminder of the popular support garnered for Belgium during the First World War. Other cookbooks published prior to the First World War, such as Country Women's Association Cookbook and the Presbyterian Women's Missionary Union Cookbook, changed the name of their recipe from German pound cake to Belgian pound cake to remove the reference to the enemy. In 1926, Flora Pell was asked by the Victorian State Dried Fruits Board to compile a recipe book with 50 recipes containing only dried fruits. And this cookbook was distributed free of charge to encourage more Australians and Victorians to eat more dried fruits. Why? You know, why the focus on dried fruits? Well, one of the reasons was that Australians were only consuming about one-third of the fruit that we were growing, and the rest of it was being exported. And much of the fruit that was being grown by returned soldiers. So soldiers on soldier settlement farms. So therefore, cooking with dried fruits was seen as another patriotic act and a way of supporting soldiers who'd returned from the war. Another outcome of World War I was the increase in popularity of the temperance movement. Now, you all know what the temperance movement is? Yes, good, right. Some people today don't. The membership of the Victorian branch of the Women's Christian Temperance Union nearly trebled during the 1920s, from about 3,000 in 1920 to nearly 9,776 members in 1930, and they were the largest state branch. Their political power was evident after they successfully campaigned for the closure of Victorian hotels and public bars at 6 p.m. in 1916, and they helped to convince 47% of adult Victorians to vote for the reduction or abolition of liquor licences in a referendum in 1920. Now, our cookery book was first published in 1916 during the depths of the First World War. And as we've already heard, Flora Pell promoted patriotism and believed that nation building starts in the kitchen with good, nutritious food. She argues that the housekeeper is in a position to wield tremendous influence on the mind and body, hence upon the family, society and the nation. I'm going to come back to the temperance movement in a minute, but I just need to mention that the genesis of our cookery book was in Flora Pell's extensive teaching career in Victorian schools. So by the time she publishes this book in 1916, she's been teaching cookery for over 27 years. So when she publishes her book, or when she wants to publish her book, she writes to the education department requesting permission for our cookery book to be used as a school textbook. And this, the idea was that it would replace the loose recipe cards that students were required to purchase for 1 shilling. So they had to purchase 30 cards for a shilling, and they would always lose a card and then have to buy another one, etc. But the education department refused her request, saying that they didn't want their students to have to purchase a book. Flora Pell was undeterred. Our cookery book was published by Specialty Press, and at a retail price of 1 shilling and 6 pence, it was quickly taken up by cookery teachers and students who felt they were getting much more value for money to buy a book than to buy these 30 little cards. So publicity for the cookbook in newspapers proclaimed, "This book is the new textbook for all cookery students in the government high schools and must be in the possession of all." When the education department saw this, Flora Pell received a strongly worded letter from her employer demanding to know on whose authority had she issued a textbook. So Flora Pell writes back to the education department and says that she worked on the cookery book in her own time. She did not authorise the use of the words textbook in the advertising. And then she goes on the offensive and she quotes an independent reviewer who expresses this opinion in the Argus. "It is doubtful whether any cookery book has yet been issued which would make the work as easy as this does for young housekeepers." And I think that's one of the reasons why her book is regarded as a Bible and why so many people still treasure it and love it today. So then Flora Pell gets another letter back from the Education Department on the 26th of August 1916, stating that our cookery book was not approved by the minister and could not be recognised as a textbook, and they intend that this will close the matter. Well, they didn't know who they were dealing with. It's unclear from the records in the Victorian Public Records Office whether Pell actively encouraged the use of her cookery book in schools or just neglected to discourage its use. But in any case, our cookery book gradually replaces the department's recipe cards. Its use as an unofficial textbook may have gone unnoticed by the department, if not for the vigilance of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. In 1926, 10 years after our cookery book was first published, the Women's Christian Temperance Union discover that schoolgirls were using a cookbook that contained half a cup of brandy in a fruitcake recipe. Shock horror. But, as I've already said, remember how strong the temperance movement was in the 20s? Its popularity was growing, its political power was immense, and alcoholism was a real problem after World War One. You know, it was the cause of a lot of domestic violence, a lot of street violence, and there was a really strong push to try and improve society by removing the scourge of alcohol. And it was, you know, there's the White Ribbon campaign where girls would join a club and wear a white ribbon and sign a pledge to never drink alcohol. And it was a very, very strong movement. They had a lot of political clout, and the education department was well aware of this. So they doggedly, the Women's Christian Temperance Union in Victoria, doggedly lobbied the education department for 2 years and are finally successful in having all recipes with intoxicating liquor removed from subsequent editions of our cookery book. So what happens in this fight is that Flora Powell argues her case. She says that we never cook the fruitcake recipe in our classroom because it takes too long to prepare and too long to bake in the oven, and we wouldn't have that much. We don't have 5 hours in a classroom to bake this cookbook, to bake this recipe. So I'm not teaching girls to learn how to cook with alcohol, and that you have to have a bit of alcohol in the fruitcake to preserve it and to keep it. And it's only half a cup. Anyway, no, no, no. And Specialty Press, her publisher, don't want to lose this incredibly popular, well-selling publication. So they write to the education department and say, look, we've removed all recipes with alcohol in them, and we've removed any advertising about alcohol. So it's all going to be okay. So they republish the cookbook without alcohol in it. So I think that, in a sense, our cookery book is an example of the power and the persistence of the temperance movement in Australia in the 1920s. What's ironic is that Flora Powell's writings about food indicate that she subscribed to the ideals and the principles of the Women's Christian Temperance Union and the Associated Housewives Association. So all three, Flora Powell, WCTU and the Housewives Association, encouraged women to continue in their traditional domestic role, and they elevated the importance of the housewife. Now, the Women's Christian Temperance Union are happy now that the alcohol's been removed from the recipe book, but the Education Department is not, because her cookbook is still out there as a textbook. So Flora Powell is called before the director and the two top bureaucrats in the Education Department on Saturday, the 14th of July 1928, and reprimanded for publishing a book for cookery teachers in Victorian schools. And she's also accused of promoting her book in schools and then collecting the royalties. So there is a conflict of interest. At this point, the department considers publishing their own textbook, and they do the maths, and they calculate that after the costs, they'll make a profit of about £300 a year if they were to publish their own textbook. And they actually commission the start of this textbook, and they ask Flora Powell to be one of several co-authors. Quite a humiliating, you know, thing to be asking someone to do, I think. However, then they discover, in a typical act of bureaucracy, that there's 1,900 sets of unused recipe cards sitting in departmental offices. And they tell all of their schools that the students are to purchase these recipe cards until they're used up, rather than the books. It's not the end. Powell's loyal colleagues petition the department on her behalf, stating that they want to continue using our cookery book and pointing out that it contains information about nutrition and how to use the best cuts of meat, that it is not in the recipe cards. The education department ignores these pleas from its own teachers and accuses Powell of orchestrating a campaign and seeking to undermine the authority of her employer. She's accused of treason, in a sense. So, as a result of all of this, Flora Powell resigns from teaching due to ill health in November 1929. So this brings to the end a 46-year career of a teacher who, in 1908, you might remember, is praised for her efficiency, professionalism, tact, skill and ability. I think it's amazing to think that this seemingly innocuous cookbook could cause so much trouble and lead to the downfall of a competent and highly regarded teacher and administrator. And I kept asking myself, if Flora Powell was a male teacher who showed this kind of initiative, dedication and expertise, would she have been treated so appallingly by the department? Another area in which Flora Powell's cookbook reflects changes in society is the link between food and the environment. This is one of the drawings that is in our cookery book, and then you also get drawings of a cow and a pig as well. From an environmental point of view, Flora Powell was probably ahead of her time in advocating and providing recipes for alternative sources of meat, alternative sources of protein to meat. And she also encouraged cooks to use many different cuts of meat so that no part of the animal was wasted. Who can remember recipes for using tongue, tripe, brains, tails and trotters? Well, these days all we do is chicken breasts, you know, and the other bits of the animal seem to get used for fertiliser or cat and dog food or whatever. So I think today we would do well to heed Flora Pell's advice about minimising food wastage and making economical use of the cheaper cuts of meat and leftovers so that we leave a smaller food footprint on our planet. Australians now waste $5.2 billion worth of food every year, which gives Flora Pell's cookery book some contemporary relevance. This finding was revealed in an Australian Institute survey into the amount of food that Australians throw away uneaten and the reasons why, including our behaviour and our planning around meal planning, shopping and food wastage. Figures like that confirm the importance of education about food that goes beyond the kitchen. The environmental costs of this sort of wastage are huge, and the impact on our budgets, our household budgets and grocery bills, is enormous. Flora Pell understood the way food traverses the boundaries between public and private, between the broader community and home. For Flora Pell, food was political. It was a source of civic and personal responsibility. She offers her readers two things simultaneously: a self-image that fitted a fairly traditional female role of the woman as nurturer and homemaker, but then also broadening that role so that women embrace a new and maybe less familiar civic role as nation builders. Her food writings both reflect social changes and advocated for them. Our relationship to food provides insights both to our past and our present, taking the value of food writing clearly beyond the kitchen to what it communicates much more broadly about our society and our attitudes. That's all. So I'm happy to try and answer questions and would love to hear your thoughts or comments about that. I think we're doing the microphone.
Speaking of those cookery cards, I'm just wondering who wrote those recipes, who provided that?
They were probably written by Miss Fawcett, I'm trying to remember her surname, who taught Flora Pell. And one of the delights of being a historian is that every now and then you strike gold. And when we wrote that article for the Age Epicure, one of the people who responded was actually the step granddaughter of Flora Pell, and she had inherited some of Flora Pell's original cookery cards that were in the education department, because that's how she was taught to cook, from those when she went to school in the 1880s. So I think they were probably written by Miss Fawcett, who had taught Flora Pell. Yeah.
Thank you, Sharon. Well, thank you for a very interesting talk. I wonder how many male teachers wrote maths books or science journals and weren't in fact held up for that kind of thing.
I wonder about that too, yeah. And this is another little bit of gold, is that doing archival research is often frustrating because it takes a long time to dig through departmental files. And all of this correspondence between Flora Pell and the department was in a file named Red Cross Society. And so you'd never sort of think to look there. It was just a footnote in someone else's research that led me there. And I had an hour left at the archives in Melbourne and went, oh my God, there's so much stuff here. It was fantastic. It really is like striking gold. So I haven't looked into other correspondence files in the education department, but that would be really interesting to do. And what's also interesting is another thing Adele and I have just discovered is that Flora Pell taught in the public education system. there's a private education system running alongside of this where women from more middle class and upper class families would go to night school or schools during the day to learn to cook. And so Florapel actually has a competitor. So there's another woman, Grace somebody, who publishes a cookbook in 1915, very similar to Florapel's, in Victoria. They must have known each other. So that's the next little tangent of our research.
Do you know if the schools or when the schools started to teach housewifery and laundry as well as cooking? Because it's a while ago now since I went to school, but that was part of our curriculum.
Oh, when did they start to teach that? Is that what you're asking?
What's that?
Well, are you asking when, like what year or so did they start?
I was wondering whether the cooking schools did teach those skills.
They did, yes, they did. So we can look at the prospectus. So the department had a prospectus from 1912, which had both cookery and laundry skills and sewing and things like that, yeah.
Tom Campbell. Two comments. One, you talked about this issue of around the 1930s about women in the home, or earlier before that, women in the home. Yes, I happen to work in mostly Catholic church history these days, but I've worked in Anglican church history and the education systems. And I can assure you that as even as recently as 1930, there were Catholic bishops lamenting the fact that women were being too well educated, that their right and proper place was in the home, caring for the family and being the driving force of the family. And the registrar of the Sydney University in one particular case lashed out and said, well, we actually do have students doing advanced degrees and things like that. And the second issue is that Pell was talking about them being trained in these things. I don't believe that she was saying they shouldn't be well educated in other things, because equally there were convents, and I'm particularly thinking of the Dominican sisters at Santa Sabina in Strathfield, and a brilliant woman there back in the 1920s called Sister Angela, who actually grew up in the back of Walgett, New South Wales, who wrote incredible stuff about the fact that we lock ourselves away, women should still be taught astronomy and all sorts of other things, not just limited to the home. So it cut both ways.
No, yeah, that's definitely true, Tom, and I do agree with you, because Florapel was advocating for the establishment of domestic arts colleges where the girls would be there 2 days a week and then the other 3 days of the week they would go to a high school and learn, as I said, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic and all and other subjects as well. And what would happen with these domestic arts colleges is that they could be then converted into Sloyd classrooms. Amazing sort of co-location of teaching. So the other 2 days, so it would swap over and then the boys would come and use them for woodwork and things like that. And I wonder if in the night, your first comment about bishops and priests saying that women should be in the home a bit more in the 1930s, I think it's important to remember that that was around the time of the Great Depression as well. Work was very scarce, and so there was more of an emphasis, I think, on finding jobs for men than on finding jobs for women.
Would your research into the impact of her teaching on society include the relative position now, where, as you say, we use chicken thighs and throw the rest away? When we came to Australia as migrants, or when we first married too, I remember Mary used to buy a chook, and then out of the innards would come these claws which slowly opened, and she hated those things, you know.
The
frozen chickens.
The feet back inside.
Oh, really?
And you defrost them, and you had to pull them out. and don't slowly open, you know.
And it also had the giblets in there. Now, I can't imagine us going back to that because the accent now is on pressure, on time limitations, etc., etc. So the change has been very dramatic. But would your research actually compare those two things as to how far we've come downhill, or if you can call it that?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, and maybe one that we should pursue. And I think we're starting to see a little bit of a flip the other way, because I think it's Maggie Beer that has her recipe for spaghetti bolognese includes chicken livers. So, you know, some cooks are starting to advocate that we use more parts of the animal and things like that. And starting, yeah, you make pate from chicken livers and things like that. And people are starting to go back to basics in a sense and make their own stock where you would use, you know, the other bits, the feet and the neck and other things like that. So there's kind of a little bit of a swing of the pendulum back the other way, but there's not the education to know what to do in the kitchen, know how to use those cuts of meat, I think. So, yeah, it's an interesting area and one that we should pursue. Thank you.
Yes. I went to a home science school. That's what they were called in New South Wales. Mm-hmm. In the latter part of the 40s, I mm-hmm. suppose. And I was wondering whether the cookery book, I've actually did donate it to the collection here. I wonder who wrote the cookery
the
books
cookery.
At that time. No, not Common Sense. It was an Education Department cookery book. I don't think it was Common Sense.
Hmm.
It's in the collection. It's a little fawn-covered thing, but
Well, the ones I've seen just say written by New South Wales home ec teachers, like a collective of teachers. I'd have to go and have a look at that particular book to answer that question.
And it was during the war, of course, and everything was very scarce.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, World War II. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. I should also just mention that I don't know if you know the Eternity Gallery in the National Museum. Well, Flora Pell's story will be in the Eternity Gallery from October this year in a much more condensed form, because we only get five images, five quotes and a little, you know, video and an object. So her cookbook will be on display in that gallery. So after October you can go and have a look.
I'm just wondering, did you do any research on the follow-on after she gave up teaching? I didn't take note of her death date, in regards to the Emily McPherson School, because that was definitely Victorian, more well-known than the Collingwood one.
Yes,
in
yes.
our era anyway.
Yeah. So the Emily McPherson School starts during Flora Pell's teaching career. I haven't got the date with me, but it's definitely happening in the 1920s. Privately funded, so private fees. So it's one of those parallel things happening at the same time as Flora Pell's work. Oh, that's right. It's just coming back to me now. So the one of the things that the Education Department does when they're tossing up whether what to do about Flora Pell's cookbook, her textbook, is they commission an independent cookery teacher who happens to be the headmistress of the Emily McPherson College to give them an independent assessment of her cookery book. And so this letter is in the Education Department files, and this incredibly catty woman says, well, actually, it is a very good cookbook, and if I had had the time, I would have written something like this myself. So, you know, the Education Department is getting independent advice saying it's a great book and we use it at our schools. It's getting petitions from their teachers saying we don't want to go back to the recipe cards. It's a retrograde step. Our students love this book. They think about commissioning an original, you know, their own textbook and putting, and they actually put together the team to start writing it. And then they discover these 1900 sets of recipe cards wasting away in the back shelves, which today, you know, when I think about the amount of paper that we recycle at the National Museum, you know, we just get popped in the recycling bin, seriously. So it's sort of unbelievable that this happens in a way. But there, I think it's a, it's a battle between David and Goliath, in a sense, between Floripel and this all-powerful...
Did that book eventually come out?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
So the cards continued?
The cards continued until the Education Department in Victoria then gets its own version of the Common Sense Cookery book, which they probably borrow from New South Wales, I'd say. But that's more, you know, we could do more research about that. But I think Floripel is really interesting because of her writings about the importance of food and the importance of the home and women's role, which you don't get that sort of political statements in later cookbooks, which more focus on the recipes and the food and nutrition and things like that.
What did she do after, I think, was the question?
Oh, yeah, so 1929 is when she retires due to ill health. She marries in 1935, and so during that time, there's some records to say that she was the judge of, the best cake at the Melbourne exhibition. So, you know, like the local shows, she was asked to come and judge cooking competitions. I haven't found any other sources, because after that, she disappears from the public record, and we've only got private material to go by. The other interesting thing, I guess, is that when we did a little bit of genealogical research, we discovered that her siblings and her mother all die before she's 18 years old. So it's just her and her father who are still alive. Her father then remarries quite quickly, and his new wife has about four or five children, and then the father dies. So we're not sure if Floripel, in a sense, becomes the breadwinner, earning money to support her stepbrothers and sisters from this later marriage. And she certainly then goes on to support her husband, who is older than her and predeceases her, and they lived in Kew. So, and I think the children of her husband are not very happy when he remarries quite quickly after the death of his wife. So, you know, there's some interesting stuff there that could be teased out, but we just don't always have the public records available to do that. Yeah.
I wonder what her religion was and if she might have been related to the present Pell in Sydney.
we're pretty certain she's not related to Bishop Pell, but like most people in that day, she did go to church, from what I can gather. Yeah, but I don't think she was Catholic, so she would have been Protestant. Yeah, yeah.
Just on that score of the modern focus on perhaps better cooking, the reality series MasterChef, and especially the junior MasterChef. I know that's probably not included in your research, but that seems to me a fascinating thing to actually introduce very young people at a very impressionable age into the wonders, I suppose, of cooking. I was never such, and I'm still not in that particular category. I've got such a better cook here than I would never attempt. But it's terrific that a lot of people knock reality shows, but that little show, especially of these junior master chefs, was just fantastic, I think.
Well, actually, Adele Wessel has done some research on that, and her paper is published in an online journal, and I can flick Sharon the link if you are interested. Adele has two children aged 9 and 7 herself, and they were avid fans of Junior MasterChef. But one of her criticisms of it is that on that show, they're often cooking things like prawn souffle or, you know, sort of these really kind of outlandish recipes that I could hardly ever get the ingredients for, let alone, you know, bother to cook for an evening meal. And also the sense of competition that it brings, rather than creating an environment where cooking should be a relaxing and enjoyable experience. Yeah, so Adele's done a bit of a critique of that and looked at its impact on the way we think about food today, and I'm happy to send the link to you. And there's also, Adele and I have written an article for Recollections, which is the National Museum's journal, which is available online as well if you want to have a look.
I think that's probably all we've got time for, because Alison has to unfortunately get back to work. So thank you so much, Alison. It's been a delight this morning. Our next Friends event is Friday for Women's Voices, which is at 10 a.m, and we have Kate Carnell speaking. And yes, that's our program for this month. Thanks.
Thanks, Sharon.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.